Anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, you can reach us at 888-228-4494. Canada, you also have your own toll-free line at 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154, 530-776-5185, or 530-776-9916. And those of you that are using the internet for your long distance with Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio and through Paltalk at BBSRadio_com. I also wanted to give you an update on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Our producer in Hollywood, Emerald Films, is working very closely with a well-known film funder. We should hear something this week on the viability of actually taking the voyage, which many are calling the greatest expedition in history. As you know, last year we won the Genes of Galileo Award with our documentary on the hypothesis that the Earth might be hollow. And our team has devised 13 days worth of experiments, 24 hours a day, to gather information and conduct experiments to prove or disprove that hypothesis. We have a new article coming out with the Tesla tech people this week, and we're in discussions about doing a presentation down there. So if you are interested in that, make sure you get to teslatech.com and check out their upcoming conference. Speaking of Tesla Tech, our guest tonight is John Riley. He is the owner of Zero Point Research in Santa Monica, California, and he is the inventor of the Lifestream generator. The last hour, John mentioned in his discussion a human-Earth connection, and we have researched that a long, long way. In print, we've taken many voyages to distant places on the Earth, and we have seen ancient civilizations speak about this communication between the human being and the planet Earth. It seems that this connection is undeniable, and it is not superstitious. It is not religious. It may be, in fact, energetic. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour, that the birth of this technology that Zero Point Research is bringing forth, this John Riley invention, has a lot to do with the connection of energy to the human biology. And I guess we'll open it there. Are you there, John?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's see if we can give 55 minutes of a short physics lesson combined with advanced molecular biology, and we'll see if how many people we can't lose. Oh, I think we have a caller on line two. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Gail from Tennessee. How are you doing tonight, Brooke?
Oh,
I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Oh, I know, I know. And you're a good friend with William Henry, too.
Yes. You know, while you guys were talking about alternative energies and stuff, and fuels, I just find it really interesting, and you still have to think that this is probably part of the big game, you know, that the Illuminati play with their little chessboard. And because my father's a big farmer in Kansas, over 3,000 acres, do you know that the government pays him every year to let that land set idle?
That's
so
funny,
it does not produce crops? It's nothing wrong with that land whatsoever.
Yep, we see a lot of that up here in Washington, too. A lot of wheat land just sits there doing nothing, and they collect a check.
Yes. They're paid not to farm it. And did you know that once you sign into that program with the government, that if you, they are leasing that land from you. You gave up your rights to it. And if you ever are in non-compliance with government protocol on it, they can seize your land. I bet a lot of these farmers don't know that.
Can you ever back out of the program? Can you say, you know what, I'm tired of this. I want to use my land for something else.
No. It's kind of like on your oil and gas leases on farmland and stuff. Those leases are for lifetime of the lease.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Because my dad has some oil rigs that are leased out to oil companies, you know, that do the drilling and stuff. And that's what it's called, a lifetime lease.
Whose lifetime? The lifetime of the farmer or the lifetime of the land?
Lifetime of the land. As long as that entity, that corporation or company that is the drilling company is in existence. But what they usually do is sell is they, you know, someone else comes in and buys it out. So they have perpetual.
That's pretty amazing.
Isn't it?
You have any questions for John?
I do. You know, there's these things that keep circulating around the Internet. It's like the gossip now. What was the, when I was growing up in the 50s, it was the local phone that there was four or five, the party line. You know, everybody could listen into everybody's conversations. And it seems like today now we have the Internet takes place of that, although I'm much more sophisticated. But this little black box that gives free energy keeps coming up all the time. And that there's actually, and this, not only will this type of technology be for running households for electricity and everything else, but would also same energy can be harnessed for automobiles and everything. Do you know anything about that? And if you do, where do you see the timeline with the protocols on that and the prototype?
Well, yeah, the actual black box that's running around the Internet, there's probably several of them that claim to be free energy devices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we talk about is that when we use the word free energy, I think it's easier for us to say that it's energy that we do not take from the grid or energy that we do not plug into and recharge. We can grab it from the etheric realm itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we look at that, there are many ways that that can be done. I mean, I do experiments. You know, Tesla did experiments in Colorado Springs where
mm-hmm.
where he powered the city, and he also was able to create a grid, you know, of radiant energy and transmit it, and then he could put light bulbs down into the earth and they would light up with no wires. So
I
the technology has been there, you know, and even in the 70s, you can go on YouTube and punch in, free energy or wireless energy, and you'll see some old footage where the government was taking these arrays and sending wireless energy like a mile and a half across these canyons and maintaining 85 to 89% efficiency. You know,
was that with the Tesla towers?
No, this wasn't the Tesla towers. They were actually doing, it was called a gallium arsenide array. And they were actually, but there's a lot of it, you know. I mean, there's a lot of research, you know, in regards to wireless energy transmissions or devices. Australia, apparently they're doing some amazing work down there.
I've heard that lately.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of breakthroughs that, you know, again, it's all about, you know, okay, now that we can do this, how do we implement it, you know, effectively? And this is where it gets tricky, because if I said I had a device, you know, that would, you know, you can power anything 5 feet away from it. You don't need any cords, but it has to plug into the wall or you have to charge it some way. Now, free energy, we can call that solar cells, you know, because we're taking photovoltaic, you know, energy from the sun, you know, and then store it into batteries. And, you know, the bigger the cells are, the more battery power or storage capacity we have, we can store a lot of energy that way, but there still is a cost factor.
Speaking of solar technology, have you heard about this, I forget what university has developed this now, but it's like a Painon nanoparticle type solar panels that are a lot cheaper, and they're going to be more cost-effective for the average person out here to do, because, you know, to totally go solar for your home, that's big bucks.
It is big bucks, and yeah, it is. It you know, of course, it's a long-term, you know, investment when we look at it from that aspect. Solar technology, I think South Africa's got a breakthrough technology as well that was, you know, literally increasing 200 to 250% efficiency from a cell, You know, so that, again, we're seeing some amazing breakthroughs on that level as well. You know, again, what we still have, almost with every type of technology that goes into production, we always have the manufacturing or the mass production aspect. It's almost the same thing as, you know, when you bought your first DVD player. You know, you paid several hundred dollars for it, and now you can get it for $69 because they've been mass produced, and there's an infrastructure set up. So we have to, once, and here's what a lot of people don't know. I will have to use this as a reference because it boggled me for a decade. Is that I used to go to the consumer electronics shows every year religiously. And when DVDs came out, they announced the single layer and also the multiple layer ones, the dual layer and then the Blu-ray technology. And that technology taunted us for 10 years before they finally released the technology to the consumer. You know, because they had to get all the manufacturers to agree what to deliver first. And, of course, they delivered the single layer first. Because if they would have delivered the seven-layer Blu-ray technology or the five-layer Blu-ray, the first-layer technology would have kind of been worthless. No one would want it. So there's always a control or a paradigm structure that's placed, you know, for technology. And it's always been that way in regards to bringing technologies forward.
Well, and there's another problem with this, too. I mean, these large corporations, if any inventors out here, physicists, you know, all that, they come upon something and they get a working prototype, the next thing you know, you've got these large corporations, the government out trying to buy it, claiming, you know, all this is revolutionary, and we're going to use that and we're going to, you know, implement that into our manufacturer line, and next thing you know, they buy up the rights to it, you know, the patents, and then they set it on a shelf somewhere. And if these people continue on, there's been a lot of people that have had just absolutely phenomenal breakthroughs that are dead today.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's you're kind of treading into an area that I know a little bit about, and that is high-speed manufacturing and large corporations. In reality, and, of course, we've had an open call for well over 18 months now for any prototype whatsoever in new energy. We've got empty factory floor space right now waiting for any new energy technology. And we've been through well over 100. And there are groups out there that kind of bird dog these things and vet them, as it were, to see if they're real or not. But we have yet to really have a good working prototype come forward. So I know there are lots of rumors out there, and there are lots of people that have taken someone else's idea and called it their own, and then when they realize, oh, gee, that's already patented, you're infringing on the DuPont's patent or GE's patent, well, then, of course, GE has the right to defend their idea. But the idea that there are inventors out there making millions of dollars selling their ideas to large corporations is rumor.
Yeah.
It's not out there.
Oh, no, they come in and buy it up for pennies on the dollar and promise them all kinds of stuff, and they have no intention of using
well,
that
I don't
for
think
the good
so.
Of humanity.
I don't think so. I don't think that technology gets sold. I think there are small groups out there, and I'm not going to mention any names, but...
Yeah.
They sufficiently destroy these inventors before they ever get their feet off the ground by just starving them out.
Right.
They just never get their idea out there.
Dr. Eggman, have you ever heard of a gentleman named Marco Rodin?
Sure. I interviewed him on this program. He's the inventor of the Rodin toroidal coil.
Yes. Yes. I watched all of his videos the other day. Absolutely phenomenal.
Great stuff.
It actually... I kind of had an epiphany when the whole principle of how this works, this universal energy part, and I began to think, well, you know, the chakras are like an oscillating vortex when you think about it, the chakras of the human body. And I can see where this same mathematical schematics could be used to develop instruments, equipment that could heal the bodies, human bodies, through working with the oscillating vortexes of the chakras. I mean, that what he's doing, and then he just wants to give this to humanity. He doesn't want any money from it. And he's frustrated. I talked to him the other day over there in Hawaii. He's actually moving out of the United States. He's looking for somewhere else in another country to go. He's not sure where he's going, but he's leaving. He wouldn't elaborate with me on why, but he sounded pretty upset. And he said he's just not getting anywhere. There's no one that wants to truly help humanity. He says, you know, I've left this for everybody at their feet, and it's up to them to take it and run with it and use it however they can. So what do you have for comment about that, Brooks?
Well, I think I understand this technology. I've never actually seen a working one. I've seen his drawings. I've seen his math. We've talked for 3 hours on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a smart person. He's got a lot of practical designs about him. And I think that his technology is viable. But the idea is, you know, to create a working prototype and get it in the hands of people who could mass produce it and apply it.
Mm-hmm.
Does he actually have a prototype or working unit?
Yeah, he does.
I've never actually seen one, but they say he does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's actually, I guess he went to some of the big players with the governments and stuff. Well, that's futile.
Well,
not where I would start.
Gail, can I play? Gail, can I play a little scenario out with you?
Mm-hmm.
I do this with people when they feel that that we're caught up in the government structures. I like to as an inventor, when we bring something that has monumental changes. Or that can really do something incredible for the world or the people.
Right.
We have to really look at what we have. Now, I always consider this the test, because one of the things I play out scenarios all the time. Let's say I'll use the automotive company for an example, and I created a technology that would allow engines to run on water.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was excited about it. I built a prototype, and I went to one of the big automotive companies, and I said, here, you put this in your vehicles. All vehicles will run on water from this point. Now, there's a lot of scenarios from that point that could happen. They could make me an offer, or they can say we're not interested.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can make me an offer and then do play me out for a long time until I'm just financially destitute. Now, realizing that, I would have, whatever the outcome, because if you did sell it to the company, you'd be calling them for 10, 15, 20 years. Hey, when's my technology going to come out into the cars? Oh, we're working on it. We're working on it. We're working to implement it. Well, how come it wasn't out 15 years ago? Now, when we understand paradigms, it's very important to really understand that they're there for so many reasons. Now, I take this to another scenario. Let's play out another one. Now, in my frustration or in my pursuit to get this technology out, I go to an independent, someone that's, a multi-billionaire, ten times over, and he had a bad day, when I was able to pitch, it was actually a good day for me because he was so out of balance, he just lost a bunch of money in oil, and he was looking for something different. And here it just so happens I walk in and I go, hey, I got this device that can revolutionize and get us off of oil. And he looks at it and he goes, this is great. Let's do it. What's it going to take? 5 years and $2.5 trillion. And he goes, let's do it. Let's implement it, but let's do it secretly. So what we do is we go secretly and we develop this technology and we have it all in warehouses. And he announces it publicly. And we're sitting there with a smile on our face, and all of a sudden we make it affordable for everyone.
Uh-huh.
So now this technology is just a key word. Everyone's going and getting it, putting it in their cars. Now they're off the grid. They're no longer using fossil fuels. So now, let's say 90, 100, maybe 6 months down the way, I finally give my investor a call, and I go, and they put me through, and I go, hey, did you see CNN today? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I think we're responsible for that. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't expect that we'd have global economic collapse because we didn't think about what we were doing. And now, because all the countries and all our government structures and all the companies that produce fossil fuels are no longer needed. And so we created
right.
this huge, collapse throughout the structure. And
we are
feel really bad about that.
We're an oil-sucking economy.
Well, but it's part of our economic structure. It's part of our means and our usage. So now all of a sudden we brought something in that drastically changed that, and now we did something we didn't want to do and create global economic collapse. And so now I'd say, go boy, I wish I could have went back and did that differently. So now playing out that scenario, let's look at it a different way. Now, you know, a wise investor would take that technology and say, okay, I get it. I understand paradigms. So now we create a new device, and we walk into that company, and I go, you put this in each vehicle, you will increase fuel efficiency by 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would probably get their attention. And they go, well, we need to do that. This sounds great. And then we'd go into testing, and we go into implementation. Or we get the same scenario out and get that independent, and he would build them, and we'd make them public. We're guaranteeing 20% fuel efficiency. And that's it. So, but then, you know, because we're thinking in a paradigm shift, a slow shift in the paradigm. But what we've done is we sat down and we said, okay, this is what we're going to do. Every 2 years, we're going to create a new and improved model that saves another 20% or 15%. And in an 8 to 10 year span, we are using 80% less fossil fuels in each vehicle. Now, we'd be considered heroes in that aspect, because what have we done? We've allowed the paradigm to slowly shift, and we've reduced the usage of fossil fuels, but we didn't eliminate them.
Okay.
You know, we didn't tear down any structure, and we're cleaning the air in the same way.
But while we're playing out these paradigms, I have to ask: do you think the planet Earth, and at the rate that, well, as Al Gore says, human caused global warming. I don't believe that for a minute, but I think it's cyclical. But the pollution and stuff that fossil fuel is causing is a real concern, and it is a reality. And do you have that amount of time, I think would be my question, to let that type of paradigm play out?
Well,
you're talking years of finally getting us off of our bottle of oil.
Well, and if we did it tomorrow, what would we do to ourselves?
Well,
if we were off of oil tomorrow.
Tanking.
Hmm?
The whole economic structure of the planet was all, the minute they started creating it with the Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, and all that, it was destined for failure to begin with because of greed. You know, at whatever level you want to talk, there's been a lot of greed and a lot of deceitful things go on behind closed doors, which has caused this economic global meltdown. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to have to be concerned about economics. I think we're all going to be starting out from scratch here in the not too far distant future.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, we're looking at a lot of tremendous shifts, a lot of things happening very quickly.
All at the same time.
Yeah, well, going back to what Brooks and I were talking about earlier about, you know, of course, new electric vehicles, biodiesel companies, independents really getting involved and making the difference to give us the choices. And so that we can literally go out there, we can buy devices that will adapt our cars to run on more efficient fuels or increase the electrical efficiency of our Prius or any other electrical vehicle. These are all happening as we speak. When we look at the events that are happening and bringing a wake-up call to us on this planet that we need to do something, a lot of people woke up with Al Gore, and that's exactly what he intended to do, is to get us all waking up and talking about it. And a lot of people are moving into action. You know, that's a guarantee.
I think there's some underlying issues also there with that, because that now they're trying to promote some type of a UN international tax, more specifically pointed towards the American consumer, because we consume the most oil on the planet, because of our insatiable thirst for being mobile and traveling all the time.
Well,
but
we're the slowest
China
to come around.
Up right behind us.
Right. Well, we're the slowest to come around. Like Europe put the, if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Brooks, but they put the 2% biodiesel initiative probably about 8 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. They've been putting biodiesel in their fuel. Most states have a 2% biodiesel blend mandate, and in the state of Washington, there is a 20% mandate for government vehicles like school buses and barges and, you know, things like that, emergency vehicles. The problem is there's no supply.
Right.
There's no supply of biodiesel in the state of Washington to meet that demand, and so they don't have to buy it.
About getting the cart before the horse, huh?
No, that's not it at all. First, in this nation, at least in a capitalistic society, you have to create demand first.
Yeah.
Once you create demand and the pricing structure is there, then entrepreneurs will fill in the gap. Now, government has done a fantastic job, especially the state of Washington, for putting low-interest loans and grants in place so that people with some equity can step in, pick up millions of dollars in low-interest loans and grants, and actually build a biodiesel plant. And that's exactly what's happening here in eastern Washington State. This plant is generally specifically because, of the forward thinking of legislators in the state of Washington.
They're very progressive in Washington. I lived in Seattle for 9 years. Their government's very progressive.
We're excited about it.
Can you refresh my memory for a minute here real quick? Biodiesel is what?
Biodiesel is using generally non-food oils generated from, say, canola seed or algae.
Okay.
And we transesterify that with an alcohol. It could be methanol, it could be ethanol. A little bit of heat, a little bit of pressure, and a catalyst, and now you have a fuel. And that fuel is about 2% off of what regular diesel fuel is as far as BTUs, but because of its great lubricity and its low-cost production, it competes heads-up with diesel. I mean, diesel engine manufacturers love biodiesel. You can go into any truck stop in America, and you can buy, and you have to now, buy a quart of biodiesel to put in your tank of 50 gallons of diesel fuel. It'll treat 50 gallons because the fuel industries have been asked to take all sulfur out of the diesel fuel, and thus the diesel fuel is very abrasive to engines. It destroys steel engines. So when you add biodiesel to it, it keeps everything moving and keeps everything from wearing out. And that is what biodiesel is. It is not ethanol. It can be piped through pipelines. It's not corrosive. It's not flammable. It has a much higher flash point than regular diesel fuel. It's safe. It's not even considered hazardous. You can dump it out on the ground, and you don't even have to report it.
Well, I certainly like the idea of the biofuel far better than I do ethanol that's made from corn, because that's wiping out our ability to feed the animals on the farm industry. Because we're taking all this corn, and it takes a phenomenal amount of corn to make 1 gallon of this ethanol. It's not cost-effective.
In the Midwest, it's become so bad, what you just said, that they now have a new byline. It's called corn on corn on corn.
Mm-hmm.
These farmers are raising corn crop after crop after crop because the money is so good. And you know what? We tried that before. It's called a dust bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one business that's almost as profitable as farming the corn, and that's supplying silos to store the corn.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, there's not an ethanol plant in the country that's making money, because the price of corn is through the roof.
Right, and we're taking that corn, and we're you know, using it in the process to make this ethanol, and then it doesn't work. It's just a whole broken theory, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't work.
Well, it's not entirely broken. Let me tell you, it is low hanging fruit to be sure. But about 6 weeks ago, Green Star Products, which is a company that's very forward thinking and very active in informing lawmakers on the reality of ethanol, they put out a series of press releases that educated legislators to the reality of ethanol, that it can be produced with cellulosic sources, wood chips, corn stalks, switchgrass. These are non-food sources, scrap, that can be turned into ethanol. And sure enough, in response to these press releases, $1.2 billion was put in the most recent energy bill for cellulosic ethanol, finally.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that. Well, maybe it's about time, you think?
It's happening. It is happening. And now the infrastructure for ethanol will have to be changed a little bit. You have to move up the fruit tree just a little bit. And those people that have perfected cellulosic ethanol processes, which requires a little bit more technology, are going to take the ethanol industry to the next level. And hopefully, they won't pump it into gasoline. They'll use it to produce biodiesel. Big difference in BTUs.
So it would be part of that chain then.
Yes, exactly. Instead of pouring it into gasoline where it deteriorates the fuel mileage, you can't pipe it anywhere because it sucks moisture out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes it in fuel-injected vehicles, which everything is now.
Mm-hmm.
But ethanol can easily be used for transesterification processes to make biodiesel. It's a great process.
Hmm. And therefore, you wouldn't have to use this much either of the, ingredients.
Yep, that's right. You use up about 11% of by weight, and then 4% is recycled, and you get a little bit back out of the glycerin, and you're good to go. And every university just about in the country is looking for alternative uses for glycerin, which is a byproduct of the biodiesel process.
Huh. Interesting.
So there is progress being made.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, because if the route they're going and the things I've been reading, you know, and I talk to my father all the time, that's this other aspect's not working. And,
well, that's true.
Yeah. You know, my uncle was in the military. This is back in the 50s. And he was stationed down in, I believe it was Arizona, Fort Huachuca. And he tells about even back in the 50s that the military had a carburetor that could go 150 miles on a gallon of gas. And this was back in the 50s.
Yeah,
but they never allowed that to become a just for, you know, general population consumption type thing. That was strictly used in the military. Did you hear anything?
I don't know.
About
I
that?
Was in the military, and everything in there was gas guzzling. So I don't remember I remember 90 miles per gallon, and we do that every year when we compete in the pulse charge race. We did about 99 miles per gallon last year.
Wow.
This year we plan on taking them on and going over 100 miles per gallon.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask one more question, and I'll take that off the line here because I'm sure maybe some other people want to call in. But where do you see our ability to sustain the economic growth of China and our insatiable appetite for our lifestyle here in America? And, of course, you have India running in that deep competition. There's three powers today as far as I see it, China, India, and the United States, and we're sliding down that scale quickly. But where do you see us as far as energy changes and for better, hopefully? Where do you see us at in the next decade to 20 years?
Wow.
I'll take that answer off the air.
All right. I'm going to defer that answer to John first, and then because I think he's got a pretty good vision, and then maybe we'll discuss it a little bit. John, your ideas?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, when we see the 20-year plan of the changes, I mean, we can start with the automotive companies, you know, constantly pushing to increase fuel efficiency. So they definitely are placing those initiatives and getting the automotive companies to, you know, to be on their toes, you know, but of course they give them 10 to 15 years to do so. You know, we've been talking about, you know, hydrogen fuel cell technology for the last 15, 20 years, and it's still 10 to 15 years out before it's being implemented. So when we look at all these changes, I mean, even ethanol itself being a first level fuel, you know, that was grown, and now from this, you see it yourself, Brooks said. Now you see that the ability of algae being grown, you know, in tanks anywhere and being fed CO2 to be converted into a fuel. You know, so there's many things that are happening in regards to a 20-year outlook. You know, we're going to see some amazing, you know, changes. We're already seeing them just in the electric vehicle choices that are coming out and how many vehicles that are going to be coming out that are strictly electric or the new generation hybrids. So a lot of changes, you know, a lot of choices that are going to be given to us. I mean, if we look at the, you know, I do have to sometimes bring in awareness because I'm like realizing that back in the 70s when my parents had a late 80s or 70s vehicle Oldsmobile with the big 455 engine, you know, with this huge carburetor on it. You know, going down the highway, that thing got 18 miles to a gallon, you know, when it was running perfectly. But now, you know, when we look at some of the vehicles, you know, we're still getting about that same amount. But yes, we're not burning the same amount of at the same type of pollution. So we have so many things that we have to look at, you know, in the aspects for cleaner air. And but the fuel choices there, we do have a lot of them that are going into implementation, and we see them all around us if we do look. You know, my first, you know, biodiesel is definitely the first one that's being implemented, and that's going to get increased over the years. We're going to see higher level, you know, initiatives throughout, you know, the countries where we're going to see that. And of course, when a lot of people don't realize, you know, we're thinking about our vehicles as a consumer that drives to and fro work. The industry, the 18-wheel trucks, the ones that deliver all the agricultural products, those are the ones that biodiesel is going to make the difference, because they're going down our highways 24/7.
Those are the ones
that we really need to focus attention on. You know,
this
is where biodiesel is really going to make the difference in our cleaner
air.
You know, so that's where we really need to look. Not as like Joe consumer, you know, myself, you know, because we're just a small percentage. You know, so when we look at the, you know, of course, the harbors, you know, and we look at the possibilities there. I've been talking, you know, to Green Star as well. You know, I said, you know, really focus on L.A. Harbor, you know, with all the freight that comes in, because that's a controlled, you know, structure. The fuel comes from one place. Imagine if you convert everything over, run that on biodiesel, we can lower, so, you know, just, and that can show the changes that can happen on such a grand level for the cleaner air, you know, and also the efficiency. And actually, so that, you know, that's something that I really feel that should be focused on, is the ports themselves, because they're controlled. They're not driving all over the place. They fill up in the same place. You know, so
you don't really have to have a gas station every, you know, mile and a half for big rigs or for ships or for trains. You know, people think this nation runs on gasoline. It doesn't. The world runs on diesel. That's
exactly
what moves stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, this is really a broad question that she raised, and it kind of has three areas. There's conservation, which is an area you brought up. There's new sources of energy, which, of course, we're interested in, hydrogen, solar, wind power, water power, even getting off the grid and creating local power stations that run on something else besides the grid. But I think maybe the big question, you know, how are we going to survive as a planet? When I fly, I notice that everybody's collected into cities, and the vast majority of this country, and most of the countries, Egypt included, is uninhabited because there are no resources there. There's no water. There's no food. There's no infrastructure. That might be the way globally we need to shift in the next 50 years. We need to shift our economics from a warlike population. And she mentioned the United States, India, and China. You know, all three countries have an extremely sizable budget just for making war. And if we shifted that budget toward exploration of space, of inner space, of our planet, of new technologies for providing these basics, and we coupled this with some education so that once these basics were supplied, we didn't boom like we did in the 50s and overpopulate our planet. We do it with some sense and some planning. We might survive as a species.
Absolutely. I had the privilege to show my kids the movie Independence Day yesterday. And just for, you know, they wanted to see some of the stuff that we worked on, you know, in my business. But I forgot about the true meaning, you know, in that simple story, is that all of a sudden we had visitors from another planet that were like a locust, you know, race that just wanted our extermination. And then it's towards the end of the movie, all the nations came together as humans, you know, for our own survival. There were no more color lines, no more politics. It was about our survival as a species.
Right.
You know, and what was amazing is that what I completely forgot that set that off is that when that movie came out, Ronald Reagan publicly made a speech saying that if we were visited and we were faced, you know, with just the defending ourselves as a race, and you know, imagine how petty our politics and our you know, border struggles would become. They'd immediately fall, and we'd all unify. So playing out that scenario in the mind is really it really takes us to another, you know, humbling or just another level of seeing,
sure,
you know, our possibility of really making a difference. You're right. You hit it on the head about, you know, the war budgets, you know, for all the countries and, you know, building nuclear weapons and, you know, standing, showing that you're part of the nuclear race. You know, so what is it going to take? Yeah, it is.
When you go to Washington and you look at the budgets, you realize presidents, at least on domestic policy, they only have control over maybe, 10, 11% of the budget. The rest of it's all spoken for. They have no control over that whatsoever. And the lion's share of it goes out to social programs. The next big piece goes to the military. Now, that's something a president has control over.
Yes.
And if world leaders came together and just said, hey, you know, this little blue ball is just a little too small for us to put all our eggs in. We need to learn to live together on it and then turn our sights skyward. Let's try reducing the budgets for shooting each other and try increasing the budgets for helping the race survive and proliferate out into the galaxy. Well, that kind of brings us full circle back to the question we started this hour with, this Earth-human connection. Help us understand your understanding of this, John.
Well, one of the things that I have been seeing personally in regards to this, just it being connected with this level technology that has been, you know, brought forth, I like to call it being brought forth again, not invented, because when we realize that everything that we invent or bring forth was already part of a creative process, we're just putting the pieces together, you know, and then we see, of course, when we talked about levels of technology that, you know, were created 100 years ago, but then we find out that we're finding stuff in the sand that had the exact same principles that, you know, like the Baghdad battery that was found to be, you know, dated, you know, 250 B.C., you know, that had the same principles as our common battery now. You know, so we're really getting into a wake-up call that we are cycling, you know, and, you know, we have the knowledge of our history to really bring us to the next level. And that's and all this is happening, you know, is it a coincidence that we are taking this 23,000-year or 26,000-year journey around the, you know, to the galactic center? You know, we're coming into the densest part of our galaxy, you know, and this is the same thing in relations to what the Mayans talked about. You know, people see it in many different ways, but what I see it, I mean, when we really realize that we are coming into this alignment, and when we notice that there's an amplification and just in our solar activity, our sun, our earth, the planets in our solar system are changing, and we notice that things are intensifying even in within our abilities. We see, you know, in the news that there's a new DNA strand that's appearing in humans. All these wonderful things that are happening, and at the same time, it's all an expansion of consciousness. So when we look at the levels of energy, you know, themselves, and us finding the way to bring us to these higher levels of consciousness, you know, that's the role that I take with my technology, is to spread this worldly, you know, to raise the conscious, you know, to raise the vibration of ourselves. Now, this is a key, you know, issue within ourselves, because if we are holding what we like to call our three-dimensional selves, worrying about our bills, worrying about, you know, what our kids are doing or what's happening down the street or watching the news, we get kind of caught up. Our minds get really obstacled. And of course, when we look at certain societies or civilizations on this planet that meditate and pray, you know, and really focus and clear their minds, clear their body, and the level of awareness that can be achieved, you know, it's really interesting when you compare the two levels, and then you come into this level of higher knowledge within ourselves and higher resonance or higher frequency. When we measure our physical selves or our vibration, it gets into a really interesting, like you make a career out of it, or three or four careers, you know, really putting the connections together of the Earth, you know, human connection and how we are all connected. And when it,
what causes the vibration, or what facilitates the vibration in the biological being? I mean, we understand that we are this spirit, we are this personality, the person that stares back at us in the mirror in the morning. But the biology, what is it that makes the vibration in the biology?
Well, that's a really good question, because one of the things I like to start that off with when I talk about this is, as above, so below. Now, one of the things that we've realized is that in the human body, let's start with the brain, there's an amazing electrical storm that is constantly happening. Now, one of the things that we all have to realize, and science is definitely quantifying this, that we are energy, we are electricity. You know, we constantly have electrical pulses that are, you know, moving through us every single moment, you know, to keep us in physical form. Now, when we look at the brain, when we pull back and we look at it, there's a constant lightning storm happening through every center of the brain, sending these signals through the neural net, through our receptors, that cause us to think, cause us to have our personality, our emotions. Now, once we understand that, let's pull ourselves into orbit, and let's go up into the space station and point a camera down. We look at the planet, and there are lightning storms happening all over the planet. The same is in our brain. There are over 2,000 lightning storms happening on this planet as we speak. There's an incredible connection or balance, that I like to call ordered chaos. You know, when we look at it, there's just this amazing amount of energy, but it creates us. It creates this balance, this beauty that we're all connected to. Now, I always like to, you know, use a scenario. If I knew exactly where a lightning bolt was going to hit precisely at what time and the exact space, I would like to be six inches away from that event, you know, just to be as close connected to that energy as possible. Because we've seen in reports of people that have been struck by lightning and survived, how it literally changes them in such an incredible way, where they become more intuitive. You know, if you survive it, you know, it's one of the key factors is getting hit in the right place. But
yeah,
it's just amazing meeting these people as well, because you can definitely feel they're
from current overload.
Yeah, you don't want to, if you blow your limbs off, you know. Then.
Well, the brain itself is made of cells. So what actually is the battery of the body? Where does the electricity come from in the biology to make the brain communicate, or allow the brain to communicate and allow the cells to do their electrochemistry?
Yeah, well, even today, you know, we're still kind of mystified by how the brain controls the body. You know, and of course we can look at it from a wiring standpoint, you know, standpoint of the distribution system, you know, but when we understand, you know, the true makeup of it, and then when we realize that everything is energy and everything is vibrating, and we have, you know, billions, you know, millions of neutrinos passing through us every second, you know, and, you know, when we realize that there we are connected on, you know, and towards energy, not just from eating, but there's an incredible connection that is on an etheric realm, and then even further than that. And humans as a species, when we really realize how connected we are to this planet, you know, and a lot of us don't really realize that until we leave the planet. I mean, from a physical standpoint, you know, in the space program, even though it is hard to get this information, is that, you know, they have to use artificial standing wave generators that mimic the Earth pulse in the space flights and in the space stations to keep us in harmony out there in orbit. Because once we break the atmosphere, you know, the human body had during the early space flights had a very hard time, close to impossible to survive longer than 2 hours. We'd lose our functions, our abilities to think or to reason, and we literally curl up into little balls until they figured out this connection of these base frequencies that are also known as the Earth pulse or the Schumann pulse.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I was reading Dr. Mitchell's book, The Way of the Explorer. And, of course, you know, he was on Apollo 14 and spent 9 hours on the surface of the moon working, and then sometimes sleeping as well. And so the moon had a different pulse to it. And the lunar lander and the lunar orbiter that they were in didn't take advantage of these Earth pulse technologies. And coming back, Dr. Mitchell had this amazing epiphany, this connectedness with everything. He became detached and disoriented, and has wrestled with it for the last 30 years, trying to understand it, and created this this great book about it. So I know exactly what you're saying, that somehow the human biology, the human being, is connected with the planet Earth. And while there's an electrical storm going on inside of most people's skulls, I say most people because some people, there just aren't any lights on up there, and maybe a neuroactivity that's going on the Earth right now. Maybe the atmosphere is the brain of the Earth, and you know, these electrical storms are the way the Earth transfers information around itself. We just don't understand it. But on a cellular level, does the human battery ever get low? What happens when the voltage of the human body gets low?
Yeah, well, that's, of course, Western medicine, you know, and science also has been proving that for quite some time, that our cells lose what we couldn't call cellular voltage over the longer we live. And this has been kind of an interesting phenomenon, because that's not really supposed to be the case when we look at the way that the human body is meant to actually, it should live a couple hundred years very efficiently. You know, but we, you know, when we look at just from the basic standpoint that we have 100% of our cell voltage from when we are born to when we're about 20, you know, to 23 years of age, unless we were really rough in our college years, you know, and we do notice that. That's the reason why children heal so fast, because they have 100% cell voltage, everything is open and clear, and they're constantly in the building process and the healing process. So when we get to a certain age, like usually around, it's in our 40s, when we lower, we're down about 20 to 30% of our normal cell voltages. Let's say we're about 70%. That's when we start to gather imbalances. We start to accumulate, you know, stagnant energy. Now, one of the things in my research I have noticed is that the human species takes on choices of our environment, and we've always had the ability to adapt to any environment we're thrown in. We can go to the Arctic and we figured out ways to survive. We can go to the Mojave Desert or Death Valley and we could survive. Extreme conditions, extreme changes. But we adapt to it. We always figure out ways. Now, in the same type of, in our environments today, we have extreme conditions that we put ourselves through. You know, we can call that EMF pollution or RFI, you know, pollution. You know, these are just different ways we've still learned to adapt, and also the same as creating an electrical grid around the planet. You know, when we truly realize that the alternating current that was created is not exactly in harmony with who we are as living beings, it throws us a little out of balance. I don't like to say a lot of out of a lot, you know, but the thing is, even the creators of that technology came forward, and we've seen this a lot after about 20, 25 years when we apply a technology or a product. After, that's the true test, when we actually see the cause and effects that happens. And we've seen that, you know, from in our society, from asbestos to, pesticides. You know, then after 20 or 30 years, we remove them from, anywhere near us, and we make them, we outlaw them. You know, so there are certain technologies, even the cell phone companies had to correct, because they didn't realize until they implemented a certain level of technology that it was harmful to us. And so they changed that structure. You know, instead of putting high-powered radios near our head, we use a low-power radio and we have more cell sites around us.
Right,
so there was
right.
a change, you know, so it didn't cook our tissue in our brain. You know, because 4 watts fries an egg in 5 minutes. You know, or less. You know, it's very similar to an easy bake oven. You know, a 7-watt bulb cooks that little muffin pretty quick. You know,
yeah,
so,
it does. Amazed me. How,
but it's all part of our awareness. Yeah, it is. Seven watts is a lot of heat. I work with radios, you know, most of my life, you know, and 4 watts will burn your skin. It's, you know, it's amazing how much heat is there, especially in radio frequency aspects. So, you know, these are all the things that we learn, and we have the same protocols as when a new technology, something completely cutting edge, and a lot of people don't realize this, but there are companies that take these technologies, and they actually work with technologies that won't make it to the consumer for 20 to 30 years until
Wow.
it's been tested and then applied. You know, I knew people who worked at these companies, you know, during my Lockheed time, and it was amazing. They said, oh, yeah, you know, I can't really talk about it, but, you know, I'm working on something that, you know, humans won't even know about for 20 years. You know, and then it won't even be applied.
All this is really interesting, and what I gather from what you're saying is when we're young and carefree, our cells rebound without any problems, and we adapt to our environment without any real issue. When we're middle-aged, like 40 or 50 years old, now we've put ourselves into an environment of extreme stress. You know, we worry, and we put ourselves in situations where we have to work long hours, and we have to take care of other people. Only now our cell voltage is way down, and we can't respond to that. So it seems like there's a need for some technology to help us restore that cell voltage, help us to be able to relieve the stress from ourselves, gain some level of euphoria without drugs and without some major frontal lobotomy operation. And maybe that's what you're working on. And I think what we'll do is we'll take a quick break, take about 4 minutes here at the top of the hour, and we'll be back with more of John Riley, and we'll talk about the life stream generator and maybe how we can restore that cell voltage and be able to respond to our environment a little bit better. We'll be back after this.